Now today, it's my great, great pleasure to introduce Matt Rajansky, the Executive Director of the Partnership for a Secure America, to talk about bipartisan foreign policy. Matt and I met in a very unusual way. Many years ago, I was interviewing law students for jobs. Matt was at Stanford Law School then. And although he didn't end up working for me, he's now coming to speak for me. And I'm sure everybody's interested in not only, you know, what's going on in Washington, but what's the process? Obviously, Matt went to work for an organization, the Partnership for a Secure America, set up by senators and congressmen, former and current, that were on both sides of the aisle, that were looking for a better process, for a more bipartisan approach to how we conduct our foreign policy. Now, obviously, how effective that is you know, open to debate, but it certainly is a fascinating topic of how it actually happens behind the scenes, and Matt, obviously, been there for a couple of years now, right? Can give us a firsthand look. Matt Rajansky.
Hello? All right. I'm going to use this thing because I like to walk around and point at things, and so you'll have to bear with me if it sometimes gets too far from my mouth. So as every good public speaker does, I wanted to start this talk with some jokes. And so, you know, what's the topic for jokes? Well, Democrats, Republicans, there are plenty of those jokes out there. So what do? I start browsing the internet, as you do, looking for good political jokes. And I found some pretty funny ones. Unfortunately, none of them were really appropriate. You know, a lot of them started a Democrat, a Republican, and a communist walk into a bar. Oh, nope, can't go there. And, you know, a Democrat or Republican and Ralph Nader are trapped on a desert island, it doesn't get pretty after that. So I decided to omit the joke and just thank all of you for coming, and in particular, thank you for a little bit of optimism. I know at a time like this, when there's a poisonous atmosphere in the political debate in this country, people are yelling and screaming at each other, accusing each other of all kinds of despicable attitudes and deeds, it's easy to sort of follow the crowd, or it's easy to tune out. And so I want to thank you for your interest in talking about this topic, and I certainly look forward to a lively Q&A. So with that, let me get started with this, what I hope will be a functional PowerPoint. There we go. This is just a note. I hope all of you were able to pick up the materials out front. It's not critical, but it's kind of fun to take a look at some of the research that we've done on the actual quantitative aspect of bipartisanship in Congress over the last six decades. And I want to particularly thank Danny Kassman, who's a former PSA intern, now a student at Stanford, who's here with us today with his folks. Danny helped us put together this information, and we'll talk a little bit more about it. But this really tells the story of what's happened over the last 60 years in terms of bipartisan cooperation and the opposite. And it's mostly a downward story, unfortunately, and we'll talk more about that. So who am I and who are we? The Partnership for a Secure America was founded by these two gentlemen here. That's former Representative Lee Hamilton, a Democrat from Indiana, longtime chair of the House International Relations Committee. This is former Senator Warren Rudman, a Republican from New Hampshire. These are both political leaders who have experienced the importance and the value of bipartisan cooperation in their careers and who've set about with this organization to try and rebuild some of what used to be true in Washington, which is that Democrats and Republicans have working relationships and that on these issues of critical importance to the country, they can sit down together. Now, it helps to be a former member of Congress because you can reach out to people like these, Sam Nunn, Howard Baker, Bill Perry, Warren Christopher, Bud McFarlane, Tony Lake. These are really household names in foreign policy. Some of the statements that are in those folders that were out front bear some additional names, folks who aren't on our board but who work with us. You know, it's really a who's who in national security and foreign policy. And the reason for that is not that we're big or we're rich or we're offering these people fancy trips to anywhere. It's that they really believe in what we stand for, and that's to rebuild this bipartisan center. All right, so what is bipartisanship? Let's start with that. It's kind of a wonky term. It's something that when you hear TV commentators use the word, they usually trip over it a couple of times. They're not exactly sure what they're talking about. Well, it's neither of these two things. Like, it's not weak tea. It's not meaningless. Nor is it perfection. It's not the Garden of Eden. So a lot of people will conclude, though, that, you know, the ideal of people like Joe Biden and Dick Cheney being able to work together is impossible. Well, it's not, and I'll tell you why. Nor is bipartisanship total agreement all the time. It's not a weakened, bland, or centrist agenda. That's what I would call coalition government or European-style government, parliamentary. It's not blind to partisan affiliation, and I'll tell you why I think political parties are, in fact, very important. And lastly, unfortunately, it's not a guarantee of good policy. Bipartisanship alone is not enough. This is a quote I like from Lyndon Johnson, because here he talks about consensus. And it's important, I think, to describe bipartisanship as being something other than consensus, mostly because it's a process. Consensus is an outcome. He described himself as a consensus man, and if you look at some of the outcomes of the Johnson administration, I think they're consistent with a sort of negative interpretation of that rather than a bipartisan process. Lastly, bipartisanship takes a tremendous amount of effort, and that's something, you know, rather than Paris, there should probably be a U.S. Capitol building here. It's illegal in some places. Okay, so how do we define this amorphous concept? Well, it's a process, as I said. Deliberation and interaction between two parties. It depends a tremendous amount on relationships, and we'll talk a little bit more about that. It's idea-oriented. What this means is when you talk about political issues, you don't talk about politics, you talk about facts, you talk about reality. So we face a national security threat or a challenge. Let's talk about the essence of those issues, and let's not talk about the political talking points, the votes, all of the trappings that you usually hear about in the media. It's necessary for the policymaking system to function. It's particularly necessary when it comes to national security and foreign policy. And if there's one takeaway from this talk for all of you, really, I hope it would be that national security and foreign policy are fundamentally different. Look, we can disagree on everything else out there, all the hot-button social issues, and we do and we will, and that's perfectly fine. But when it comes to American lives, American well-being, and America's standing in the world, there was a long-time consensus in the country that that was something that we couldn't afford to disagree about in the way that we've been disagreeing. And lastly, in keeping with that, bipartisanship tends to emanate from major overarching national challenges, the sort of thing that was best typified by World War II or the Cold War. And with the disappearance of bipartisanship to today, one asks, do we still have those kinds of challenges? Well, I would suggest that we probably do. Nuclear proliferation, terrorism, globalization and global environmental issues, and of course the economic recession and the impact of that for development and global security. Lastly, a cautionary note, as I said, and this is a quotation from the Council on Foreign Relations, that even the best bipartisan process does not guarantee outcomes. So we've got to have the process, but that alone is not enough. A further concession, I think political parties are very, very important. So don't get me wrong, I'm not a guy who's opposed to partisanship as partisanship. What do political parties do for us? Well, for one thing, they aggregate people into effective blocks for achieving social change and achieving change in policy. Second, they crystallize issues. You know, this was the Democratic candidates debate. Each of them had to take positions on issues because they had to do that for their party platform. Speaking of platforms, they give people a convenient metric that they can compare their own views to and say, look, I'm a busy person. I'm an engineer. I'm an accountant. I'm a lawyer, what have you. I'm not a political person all the time, but I generally agree with Republicans or I generally agree with Democrats, and that allows them to be more engaged because they know, broadly speaking, where they stand. Importantly, political parties, if you have a functioning, healthy democracy, lead to turnover in the people who are in power, and that's a good thing because otherwise you would have monarchy. I'm not actually sure who that is, but it was a good coronation scene. Shah of Iran, there we go. Okay, I should know that. But here's the problem with all of this, is that we've taken it to an extreme. And so today, the debate, the discourse, and the disagreement among political parties looks a lot more like that than like a civilized conversation. So why is bipartisanship necessary? I would suggest that we start by looking at the legislative branch. The executive is a separate issue, but the legislative branch is fundamentally different from, for example, the judicial branch of government, which is what I'm trying to represent with this scene, because just having an adversarial process within the legislative branch doesn't necessarily get you to the best outcome. As George or any of the other lawyers in the room could tell you, those of us with JDs after our names have great faith in the adversarial process. If you bring forward the best arguments on both sides and you fight it out with every resource that you have, the judge will come up with the right answer or the jury will come up with the right answer from that. Well, it doesn't work that way. In the legislature, it's up to the parties themselves to come up with the best answer. And at the end of the day, if all you do is fight and fight and fight and count votes, then the votes are going to be exactly the same as when you started. You just have hardened your positions. So there needs to be a process that's a little bit healthier and a little bit more engaged and interactive than that. Some more advantages of bipartisanship. Thinking with both sides of our collective brains. This is particularly important on foreign policy. I probably shouldn't have chosen the devil and an angel, but I just like Homer Simpson. The idea is that, you know, there's a lot of valuable experience. Look at those folks who sit on the partnership's board. On both sides of the political aisle, there are people who have critical experience. So we're dealing with a crisis like Iran or a challenge like Afghanistan. We've got to tap into experience on both sides. Weakening the power of swing votes. You know, it's neat to think that certain individuals have great influence in Washington. Obviously, that, you know, the whole media business is based on speculation about who those people are at any given time. But that's not a very healthy thing for our system. If you guys recall, during the stimulus debate, there were one or two senators, by virtue of their swing vote status, who were able to completely change the content of the proposed stimulus package. That's not a healthy thing for our democracy to have individuals be able to carry that much weight and essentially disempower the entire rest of the Congress, not to mention the rest of the country. And then lastly, I would say sustainability. If you don't have support from both sides of the aisle for your policy, whatever that may be, don't expect it to last. Because if Congress has to keep funding that for 5 years, 10 years, 20 years down the road, Congress is going to change. And if Democrats in Congress never supported it, then when the Democrats take control, bye-bye funding. Another important feature of why bipartisanship matters in foreign policy is relationships with foreign governments. Think of how American administrations have changed over the years, and yet throughout that time we have had to maintain a close working relationship on national security issues with the Russians. Well, if the Russians had been able to anticipate that with each change of administration, everything about American foreign policy was going to do an about-face 180-degree turn, then probably they just would have waited out one, two, three, maybe all of these administrations. And so there's actually less effective foreign policy implementation when you have less bipartisanship within each administration and between the administration and the Congress. And probably most importantly, bipartisanship provides political cover to do difficult or unpopular things. I would say the classic issue here is trade. If you have to get support from the domestic constituency to make any kind of agreement with a foreign country, you're never going to be able to get a free trade agreement because the vast majority of American voters are going to be pressuring their members of Congress, and this happens all the time, to oppose free trade because it's bad for American jobs. Now, whether or not that's true, that's a politically popular position in the United States, and it has been for 100 years. And the fact that we have free trade agreements has happened only because you've had high-level bipartisan consensus inside Washington. So there are some pretty eloquent and powerful critics of bipartisanship out there. This is Marcos Melitzas, the founder of the Daily Kos, a big left-wing blog, Maureen Dowd of the New York Times, Matt Iglesias, my undergraduate schoolmate, who's now a prominent liberal commentator. These folks today are all opposed to bipartisanship. Of course, 2 years ago, that wasn't true. So you got to ask yourself, when you hear people calling bipartisanship meaningless, hollow concessions, hollowing out the president's agenda, you got to ask, well, do they maybe have an interest in doing that? Well, one, it gets them in the news. And two, in this case, now they're the party in power. And so it makes sense. But that's not always going to be true. So let's talk a little about the history of bipartisanship. You'll hear me cite a lot the era of Truman and Vandenberg. Arthur Vandenberg was a Republican senator from Michigan. He started out before World War II as an isolationist. During the course of the war, he came around to the view that the United States couldn't afford to be disengaged from the world. And by the end of World War II, he worked closely with Harry Truman to stand up the basic institutions of American national security, really for the next six decades. And those institutions endure to this day. The United Nations, NATO, obviously the impacts of the Marshall Plan are critical for what Europe is today. Henry Kissinger, John F. Kennedy, Chuck Hagel, Lee Hamilton, Dick Lugar, the list goes on. And includes our President Obama, who, as some of you may know, won the Nobel Peace Prize this morning in no small part because of this issue, because of his work with Democrats and Republicans on nuclear nonproliferation. I would say this is the quintessential bipartisan issue. It's an issue that doesn't have a Democratic position and a Republican position. And yet very often what you see, and I think we're going to see this in the next few months when we come up to debate the START Treaty, this is the U.S.-Russian Arms Control Treaty, the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, you're going to see hardening of political positions, you're going to see horse trading, you're going to see tough political negotiation instead of discussions of the fundamental substance of the issue based on this long tradition of bipartisan foreign policy, which the president mentions here. Now, of course, history has not been entirely rosy when it comes to bipartisanship. President Wilson, after a very popular and popular, I would say, nationwide in a bipartisan way, intervention in World War II and victory, failed to bring any Republicans with him to the Versailles Peace Conference. That was a big mistake, because as a result of that, the main outcome of that conference for Wilson, the creation of the League of Nations, failed to achieve ratification in the United States Senate, which meant the United States, essentially the creator of that institution, did not become a member. And there are those who argue that that was the main factor for the next two decades that led to World War II. More failures. Teddy Roosevelt, despite his image as a relatively centrist, progressive Republican, when he pursued free trade agreements and tariff reform, he had no support from the other side for doing that. He pushed ahead, and those policies didn't last into the 19-teens and 20s. President Carter on arms control, President Reagan actually canceled implementation of most of President Carter's agreements with the Russians. Why? Because Carter didn't have support from Republicans in Congress when he was pursuing those deals. I find Johnson and Nixon to be very interesting because essentially, they were pursuing the same war in Vietnam, and yet both of them were doing it in a completely unilateral and partisan way. And so as the war progressed, both of them lost support from the other side. Bush and Clinton failed to achieve ratification of the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty in 1999. President Bush, I could cite any number of examples, but I think the Iraq War is certainly the best. So throughout each administration, if you look back over the years, there have been some pretty dramatic failures. Let's talk about successes. One of my favorites is Wendell Willkie, the Republican challenger to FDR, actually became FDR's greatest friend and ally in supporting the United States and the U.S. war effort around the world when FDR tapped him as an ambassador for peace to go around the world and drum up support for this great war to support democracy. I mentioned the cooperation between President Truman and Senator Vandenberg. During the 1980s, then Senate Democratic leader Robert Byrd and Republican leader Howard Baker, who serves on PSA's board, cooperated to support President Carter in the Panama Canal Treaty. Famously in the 1990s, Senators Lugar and Nunn came together. They recognized the threat that was posed by the crumbling Soviet nuclear infrastructure, and they supported a program that ultimately dismantled more than 7,000 Soviet nuclear warheads. Those are things that could have ended up in the hands of God knows who. And then lastly, President Reagan actually had, despite the tension that was often felt between Reagan and Tip O'Neill, they actually had a famously cooperative relationship. They had a sort of a joking rivalry, and they managed to achieve a lot of progress on national security issues working together. Of course, one of the downsides historically of bipartisan cooperation has been that while you had consensus during the 1950s, 60s, and 70s on important national security issues, you also had consensus on social issues in what I would call pretty negative directions. So, for example, Strom Thurmond and Robert Byrd both represented Democrat and Republican. Consensus on foreign policy, also consensus on enforcing segregation. Recently, bipartisan votes seem to have been all over the map. Unfortunately, I think some of that is cut off, but what you find is high levels of bipartisanship on some of the early post 9/11 votes. Immediately after that, almost no bipartisanship whatsoever. And if you look at that graph that I have in your materials, that tends to be consistent and cyclical throughout history, that there are these ups and downs, and it's not entirely clear how we can explain that. So let's talk a little bit about causation. Why are we where we are today? I'd say the first question is the country as a whole more partisan? This tends to be a pretty popular position. People in the media, the general public will just say, well, you know, we're a divided country. We're a fragmented country. And if you look at the polling numbers on some of these issues, capital punishment, gay marriage, global warming, stem cell research, that tends to bear it out. In fact, it does seem that we're a pretty divided country. Democrats and Republicans poll quite differently on these issues. If you look at job approval of presidents during their first 3 months in office, compare Nixon in 1969. The difference between Democrats and Republicans in job approval was 29 points. To Obama in 2009, 61 point different. And it's a pretty smooth movement from Nixon to Obama of Democrats and Republicans just in a knee-jerk reactionary way approving or disapproving of the new president, someone who's barely had time to do anything, in increasing margins. Likewise, people also think that the country is more partisan than it was, and that has a self-fulfilling prophecy kind of effect. This year, Republicans and Democrats have been bickering more than usual or working together more. Well, naturally, for the last 5 years, people have been saying they've been bickering more than usual. Same thing. Compared with the past, the country is more politically divided or not more politically divided. Huge majorities consistently saying the country is more politically divided. And yet, strangely, the exception seems to be foreign policy. If you look at what people identify as the main foreign policy goals and challenges, you tend to find broad agreement. America's standing in the world, Republicans 81%, Democrats 88%, preventing the spread of weapons of mass destruction, Republicans 64%, Democrats 61%, protecting against terrorist attacks, Republicans 90%, Democrats 77%. So these are huge majorities. These are election-winning margins on foreign policy issues, and there's broad agreement between Democrats and Republicans. So what is going on and why? Well, I think a big part of the answer, I'm not going to say it's all of it, but a big part of the answer is your individual member of Congress and the kinds of pressures from both sides that the members are feeling. So let's talk a little bit about those. It starts, of course, with getting elected to Congress. And gerrymandering, which is something that comes from it's a term coined to describe Elbridge Gerry, the governor of Massachusetts, redistricting of the districts in his state 200 years ago. So it's been with us for a long time, but it hasn't gotten any better. In fact, it's gotten worse. Obviously, we have our own history with this in California, some recent efforts at reform. But if you look at some of these districts, they're just a joke. It reminds me, there's a congressman from Florida who described his district as the ideal district because he could drive down the interstate with his doors open and shake hands with every constituent. You know, it really, basically, there are two things you want to do with gerrymandering. You want to break up majorities that favor the other side so that you make otherwise non-contestable districts contestable, or you want to solidify and secure your majority so that you can keep your guy or your gal in power. And across the board, the numbers seem to suggest that gerrymandering is getting worse and not better. The other big issue, as it always is money. Why does money have an impact on partisanship in foreign policy, though? Well, I'll tell you why. Because as the average cost of an election has been going up, so 1976, $600,000 to win a Senate race, 2000, $7.2 million. 1974, to beat an incumbent in the House of Representatives, under $100,000. And by the way, it was substantially under $100,000. It was what you'd call retail politics, going around shaking hands. Today, you got to spend the money on the media, $1.5 million. So where do you get money like that? Well, you can't get hard money contributions from individuals anymore. So you've got to get it from PACs. And PACs organize people to support partisan positions, by and large, which means every time a member goes to a fundraiser and gets a bundled package of checks, $20,000, $30,000, $10,000, they're beholden to that PAC's set of interests. And it tends to be the case that if one PAC on the left is giving to you, a PAC on the right's not going to be giving to you. So that tends to have a partisan influence on elections. Now, what happens once members get to Congress? So they've already become partisan and polarized in the electoral process. They get there beholden to the people who sent them there. They know that they got to get reelected in 2 years or in 6 years if they're in the Senate. So the interests are pretty strong just on the basis of the election. But then it gets even worse when they get to Capitol Hill. We have what's called a Tuesday to Thursday work week. It basically means your average congressional week doesn't start on Monday morning at 9 a.m. It actually starts on Tuesday, sometimes as late as 6 in the evening on Tuesday. And it doesn't end on Friday evening at 5 p.m. Sure, you have your grandstanding Senate votes and House votes sometimes that go until the wee hours on a Friday night and the threats that they're going to run into vacation, heaven forbid. But typically, it ends by Thursday evening. Why is that? Well, it's so that members can come back here to glad hand and smile for their constituents and raise money and go to fundraisers and be in the papers and do interviews back home. It's because they got to get reelected. So actually, it's kind of an irony that the rise of air travel and the increasing ability of members to be back in their districts, to maintain their permanent residences here, and to do their fundraising full-time here has actually made the problem of partisanship in Washington worse rather than better. So you have more interaction with your constituents, less interaction with your colleagues. There's been an increased workload for similar reasons. Telecommunications is a huge increasing, by the way, increase of staff in Washington. In the 1960s, you saw an increase from about 3,000 total staff on Capitol Hill during the 50s to, by the 70s, 15,000 staff on Capitol Hill. And, of course, people create work for people. So that the more people there are on Capitol Hill, the more stuff that every individual member has to get done. Members sit on more committees, an average of two or three committees today. That's not including subcommittees. So that's a lot of meetings that they have to be at. There are more lobbyists, so more meeting requests from lobbyists, meeting requests from constituents who can hop on a plane just like the members can and be in Washington in a couple of hours. They've got to spend more time with the press. We've got 24-hour cable news. They've got to fill that somehow. And lastly, the impact of electronic voting. That's not quite intuitive, but it used to be that when members on the House floor voted, they would get called by name to vote, and they had to wait until their name was called so that they could raise their hand or say their vote out loud. Well, that's not true anymore. Now they have a card. They can walk from wherever they are in the Capitol to the House floor. They can stick their card in, press a button, and that's how they vote. And then they leave after that, which means they don't spend an hour or 2 hours mingling on the House floor talking to their colleagues. So the impact of all of this is they're doing a lot of work, but they're not getting to know each other, and for that reason, they're probably getting less done. This is a typical hearing in the House or the Senate, a bunch of distinguished experts testifying to an empty room. You guys probably haven't seen this on C-SPAN, but if you actually sit in a committee hearing, it's despicable. You know, these are the biggest experts on whatever the topic may be. I see this in the foreign relations committees on both sides all the time. And you've got, you know, usually you will have the chair sitting there to open the meeting. He or she will maybe stick around for 20 minutes, and then they'll leave. They'll be replaced by a more junior member and so on. So at any given time, usually you have about one member out of 30 or 40 who sit on the committee who are actually listening. So why does this matter for foreign policy? Because these are the people, remember I talked about discussions based on facts and not on partisan rhetoric? These are the people who are going to teach them the facts. These are the people who are testifying. Now, they submit written testimony. How many of you think that the members of Congress actually curl up in front of the fire and read that 30-page written testimony about the situation? Yeah, that's right. None of them do. So committee hearings, which are supposed to be the main way of discovering factual information about important issues, those don't matter anymore. Why do I have the golfers on here? Because those of you who work in the business world understand very well it's all about relationships. You can work harder but get less done if you don't value the people that you work with and you don't have people who trust you and that you can work closely with, pick up the phone when you need them. That's the problem in Congress today. A lot of media, a lot of outside critics, people in the nonprofit world like me over the past 60 years have made hay of the fact that, oh, they have such a cushy life in Washington, they're always going on junkets, they're always golfing and drinking with each other. That's actually not true anymore. That amount of scrutiny and pressure has had a tremendous impact. And so members of Congress are very busy. They're not doing stuff like this. And if they are doing stuff like this, it's with lobbyists, it's with other folks in their party leadership, and it's with well-heeled funders back home. So the result, the upshot of all of this, is that the kind of casual social interaction of the early 20th century, when the Senate was described as the most exclusive club in the world, where everyone knew each other and everyone could work together, it just doesn't happen anymore. Just some quotes about the relationship between Tip O'Neill and Bob Mitchell, the Republican leader at the time. Close friends, no more friends. All right, so just to recap structural causes. Party discipline. The parties have respectively reinforced their own leadership discipline, both the House side and the Senate side. The end of committee seniority, which means that those committees that I mentioned where expert testimony happens, where bills are drafted and first voted on, because you no longer have committee chairmanships, which are powerful positions, being distributed on the basis of seniority, they come instead from the party leadership. And that has weakened the independence of individual committees, which, surprise, surprise, means people don't go to committee meetings because they don't matter anymore. The Watergate babies, some of you may recall, in 1974, a new class of congressmen came in who were dubbed the Watergate babies. Mostly they were Democrats. They were very opposed to what they viewed as the powers that be, and so they tore down a lot of the traditional rules of the House and Senate, And that had a great impact in terms of making the members more accountable to the people. But it did also get in the way in the same theme that I've been talking about of members working with one another and getting to know one another. And then the Republican Revolution, obviously Newt Gingrich, representative of that, really the exact same process but coming from the right, tearing down the structures, tearing down the powers that they viewed as having been abused by the Democratic majorities. So the result of all of this, in the words of former Senator John Breaux, that's not John Breaux, by the way, that's Coach Krzyzewski of the Duke Blue Devils, is that politicians today in Washington are not independent actors. They're not independent thinkers. They're players on a team. And I've got Coach K on here because he's famous for taking a team and making it greater than the sum of its parts. And that's fabulous in basketball. But when we, the voters of X district in California or Alabama or Alaska or where have you, are sending someone to Washington to represent us, it's less good when that person doesn't think for themselves. Another major factor is the rise of the outsiders in what used to be an insider's game. So here I am saying this as someone from the nonprofit world, although we're not a grassroots organization. We've got the grassroots down there. This is a caricature of Ralph Nader. Some would say he really started this process when he published Unsafe at Any Speed and took down the auto industry and got new standards for safety. But there were a lot of other organizations, mostly on the left, that tapped into bright, idealistic young people in the 1960s and 70s, sent them to Washington to essentially lobby. And they had a tremendous amount of influence. And all of a sudden, people discovered that this was a really good tactic for getting things passed. So 1966, 67, 68, 69, you had a bunch of major leftist political organizations founded, all very influential. Not surprisingly, you had a conservative backlash in the 1970s and 80s. So all of those organizations were either founded or reinvigorated as a result of this. What all of this meant was that the political influence that used to be concentrated among actual lawmakers, among actual people in government, was then diffused to outside of government. Well, what impact does that have on partisanship? It professionalizes issue expertise and legislative work. As a result of that, you have organizations like the Heritage Foundation. This is essentially the government in waiting for Republicans. Likewise, the Center for American Progress, which was pretty much stripped of all of its major think tank experts when the Obama administration came in, because this is a Democratic government in waiting. But what it means is that instead of folks having to go back to the real world where they got to interact with one another, they got to work with each other, they become professional representatives of their partisan positions their entire careers. And they just wait out a change in government. They don't talk to the other side. They help build up their positions for the next time they're in power, and they come roaring back in. I would say it's gotten even worse in the internet era. Rush Limbaugh down below obviously is talk radio, but MoveOn.org, you may recall, published this famous ad, General Petraeus or General Betray Us. You know, Limbaugh, by the way, this morning, in response to the president's receipt of the Nobel Peace Prize, described that as the Nobel Peace Prize Committee was suicide bombing itself. I don't even know what that means. But the point is that this kind of rhetoric is completely unhelpful, and yet really this is what dominates both sides of the aisle today. Separately, I think there's been declining contact between officials in the administration and Congress. The Obama administration has tried to turn that around by appointing a lot of members of Congress to the administration. I think that's been helpful. And I mentioned the Netroots and conservative talk radio. The media, I think, is a huge cause of this. You probably all recognize Bill O'Reilly and Keith Olbermann. I mean, these are two guys who have literally created their own drama on the airwaves by having a feud with one another, which in their view, characterizes what this country is all about, the debate between left and right, but is incredibly destructive and, by the way, completely not substantive. And that's the problem when it comes to foreign policy. The 24-hour news cycle I mentioned, which started really back in 1980 with CNN, this is the funny thing about bipartisanship in foreign policy, right, is that there are a lot of developments that seem positive at first, you know, that make Washington and government more accessible, and yet they have these unanticipated consequences. We can talk a little more about this later, but bottom line is that there are some basic psychological principles that explain some of what's going on in this polarization. One is that it's a lot easier to judge based on partisan labels than it is to actually get to know a person, so it's just laziness. The other is that something called the representational heuristic or the rule of typical things. The bottom line is, you know, if you see Dick Cheney, that becomes emblematic of Republicans. Nancy Pelosi becomes emblematic of Democrats. There's really no middle ground because people use these convenient labels. Confirmation bias, the idea that what you already know is the only thing you can ever learn. Republicans are warmongers, Democrats are socialists. Everything that you learn or that you hear is filtered through a lens that reinforces those views. And of course, political rallies and political events are used very cleverly by both sides to reinforce those views. All right, so finally, a few things we can do to take care of this problem. The president has already begun to set the tone. He's doing a good job. This is the president hosting a bipartisan Super Bowl gathering. Hey, it's great. You know, it's social contact, Democrats, Republicans. He's serving popcorn. What a fantastic guy. He appointed Bob Gates, or rather he kept Bob Gates, a Republican appointee, as the Secretary of Defense. Jim Jones, a conservative, as his National Security Advisor. And Ray LaHood, who was, in fact, a Republican member of Congress, as his Secretary of Transportation. In addition to that, it would make a lot of sense for the president to establish working groups on specific issues that included some of these Democrat and Republican experts. You know, look, if we've got a Heritage Foundation and a Center for American Progress and an American Enterprise Institute and a Brookings Institution, why not get all those folks together and create a presidential working group? He should also consult regularly with members of Congress, not just when he needs them during times of crisis. That's something that this president has been doing better at. The last president was not so great at it. But the key is, if you don't have the relationship before the crisis hits, that's the worst time to try and develop it. And I would just say, thematically, this is not just a one-way street. Obviously, Congress has got its role to play. They've got to fix this committee problem. You know, the idea that members have got to be at 3-4 different committee meetings, it's just not possible for them to do that. And so if you want a cadre of experienced, knowledgeable foreign policy decision makers in Congress, you've got to let those people focus on foreign policy. It doesn't make sense that they also have to do banking and housing and medicine and welfare and everything else. So you've got to let people develop expertise and develop real knowledge. I think it would make a lot of sense. Congressional delegations, those are when members of Congress usually bipartisan, so a few Democrats, a few Republicans, travel somewhere. Of course, the liability of going on a congressional delegation, you learn about some foreign place, you spend time together, those are all great things. The liability is you might get caught on camera having a good time at the taxpayers' expense. So we need some kind of formal regulation and institution of congressional delegations so that members of Congress are not afraid to travel and learn about the world and, incidentally, spend time together in the process. It's a very good thing. I think we should think about restoring a two-thirds majority to overcome filibuster. You guys have heard about the 60 votes needed to overcome filibuster in the Senate. The problem with 60 votes is it's an achievable target. You can get 60 members, as the Democrats essentially have right now. Well, once you've done that, there's really no incentive to work with the other side in the Senate. So if we can, you know, and the Senate, by the way, is supposed to be the counterweight to the House, where all you need is a simple majority for just about anything. So if we can think about going back up to a two-thirds majority, there may be a little more incentive to look for not just one Republican vote or two Republicans' votes. And by the way, the shoe is often on the other foot, where it's Republicans looking for Democratic votes, but rather looking for a more broad-based engagement between the parties. I mentioned the problem with hearings. We've got to fix that. Lastly, within hearings, when folks actually show up, typically what happens is a member of Congress will come in for about 3 minutes, state his or her position, ask a question, maybe listen to the first 20 seconds of the answer and leave. That's got to end. I have a feeling George is going to exercise his prerogative as moderator here in a second to cut me off. Well, that's exactly what committee chairs need to do. Lastly, some structural reform. This is in response to the elements that I put out there, ending gerrymandering. Look, we're not going to get rid of the Bill O'Reillys and the Keith Olbermans, but what we can do is what John Stewart has done. He's been reported now that Walter Cronkite is gone as the most trusted newsman in America. Well, what was his response to that? He said, "I'm not a newsman. I'm a comedian." So we've got to classify information appropriately. If Keith Olbermann and Bill O'Reilly want to scream and yell at each other and attack one another, don't call it a news show. Call it entertainment. I think that would help a lot, so that people get to learn news from actual news sources. Open primaries, I think, would be very helpful. And redistricting reform. This is the state of Iowa, by the way, where there are 5 congressional districts. I believe currently 3 of them are Democrat, 2 are Republican. Consistently, for the last 10 years, every election in Iowa has been contested. There is no safe seat in Iowa. And that is a good thing. That means the people of Iowa get to engage with their members, but also those members have to engage with one another. They have to be reasonable. They have to be centrist. Just a word about what we at PSA are doing. There's more in your materials. We issue these high-level statements. The goal of this is basically to create political safe space. If you put Howard Baker's name on something and you put Bill Perry's name on something and Hamilton and Rudman and so on, no Democrat in their right mind is going to tell you this is right-wing drivel, and no Republican, likewise, is going to tell you this is socialist. So that's what we're able to do on important issues like nuclear nonproliferation, Darfur, et cetera. We've also created a congressional fellowship program. We take about 30 young congressional foreign policy staffers every 3 or 4 months. We put them through a series of simulated government meetings and debates, negotiation skills building. We take them to the White House. That's the last group there with Ben Rhodes, who is President Obama's speechwriter. And then we take them on a retreat. And you know what? It is fun. And I freely admit that. We take them out to have fun together so that they know each other, they can be friends, and they can work together in the future. And lastly is we try and help people to be informed. That's what this information is about. I'm very happy to answer questions about any of it. Just remember, the onus is on you. You've got to know what's going on. You've got to be able to bring it to the attention of your members of Congress. That's all there is to it. Thanks a lot for your attention.
I came in a little late, so possibly you answered this, but this is a twofold question that is related. What has happened to diminish, if not obliterate, the moderates in the Republican Party? And is party discipline with Republicans, unfortunately, not so much with the other side, stronger than ever?
So I think there are two answers to what's happened to moderate Republicans. The first answer is they've become moderate Democrats. And that's not because the Democratic Party is inherently superior. It's because Democrats have picked up the seats that used to be held by moderate Republicans, and those are in contested moderate districts. Mm-hmm. And so the same voters are just voting for Democrats at the moment. But those people could become Republicans again in the future. So I think that's partly what's going on. It's a Democratic year right now. We're in a Democratic phase. But I think the larger phenomenon, of course, is moderation is not rewarded in our system. And I think that speaks to your second question of party discipline, which is we don't have a moderate party. We have a Democratic Party and a Republican Party, and they're blue and red. And when you look at party leadership and the tools that they have today with fundraising, communications, even discipline on Capitol Hill, can anybody name a committee chair in the House of Representatives? Raise your hand if you can. Not you, Danny. Yeah. Okay. Finance, right? Good. Good. So that's one.
Chuck Rangel.
Ways and Means. Okay. Okay. So we know a few. Maybe you proved me wrong. But it's not something that comes. These are powerful folks, I'll grant you. But it's not something that comes sort of overwhelmingly to the forefront of your mind the way that the president or Harry Reid or Nancy Pelosi do. That historically was not true. If you went back 100 years, committee chairs were among the most important and influential people in Washington. And that has changed, and that's one of the things that strengthened party discipline.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'd sort of like to follow up on that. Republicans used to stand for small government, fiscal responsibility, states' rights, and few regulations, et cetera. But it seems like Clinton has become more of a Republican, and Reagan and Bush II for sure have become more Democrat because of their big governments and big regulations, spend, et cetera. So there seems to be a growing independent movement. Can you comment, do you think there will be a third? It won't be a party, it's independent. But what is the role of the independents these days?
Yeah, that's a great question, too. No, I don't think that there will be a third party. I think if you look at American history, the only times in which we really have viable third parties is when we get figureheads, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, Ross Perot to a limited extent. And I don't see who that would be right now. I think what's more likely, what you might find, is the Democratic Party is you know, flexing its muscles right now. It's feeling the achievement of the last couple election cycles where it picked up a huge number of seats. I think if that trend continues, and there's some evidence to suggest that it will, although obviously the president and his party have encountered some problems over the last year, then I think what might happen is the Republican Party might evolve to recognize that if they want to have more than 20 or 30% in any of these contested areas, they're going to have to start picking up votes from the middle. I would suggest that for Republicans, now you mentioned some of those kind of philosophical differences that have always divided Democrats and Republicans, big government, spending issues, interventionism versus isolationism, et cetera. I would suggest for Republicans probably the future lies in going back to the roots of Northeastern Republicanism, which was oriented towards small government, but effective government, was oriented towards fiscal restraint, but engagement in a global economy, international trade. I think it's inevitable that those are going to be important issues. And, of course, the liability in the political process is, as the Democratic Party grows to capture some of the center, as it dominates blue-collar voters, there's going to be a lot of pressure on it against being globally engaged. I mentioned that issue of free trade agreements. I think that you're seeing that pressure rising within the Democratic Party. So the danger is you capture the middle and you start to feel the pressure from that middle. So I think if anything is going to happen, probably the Republican Party will reinvent itself. It probably has to. The question is just, you know, will it stay out in the wilderness long enough that it does do that? And I don't know.
I think there's another interesting part about the history. Before the last election, it was very clear that Mayor Bloomberg was sitting on the sidelines in 2007 watching. And I think if the Republicans had nominated too far a conservative nominee and the Democrats had done too far to the other extreme, that he would have jumped into that race. I know that they were doing polls and stuff like that to see. So there could have been an opening if the Republicans and Democrats had left that opening for the middle. But the interesting part about that is that the way that they have jiggered the gerrymandered all the elections, they could be like California, because California is in this situation now, as a lot of people are known. Because the gerrymandering is so extreme, we've got extremists on both parties and very few moderates. And if the parties go that way, continue that way for another 10 or 20 years, then that opening might show up again. Yeah. And but that's the only thing I agree.
I'm glad you reminded me, George. Yeah. There was a very serious movement early in the 2008 cycle. David Boren, a former senator from Democratic senator from Oklahoma, led this movement to identify a third-party candidate. I don't remember what the name of it was, but he brought folks like Sam Nunn and other conservative Democrats, liberal Republicans together at a conference at the University of Oklahoma, and they ended up not picking a nominee, but, you know, they tossed around names like Bloomberg and Chuck Hagel and Nunn himself. But I think that's a great question.
You commented on the blur between politics and entertainment. Does the Partnership for Secure America have any programs to try to deal with that problem?
The short answer is no. We try and pick our battles. There's a lot that needs to get done in Washington, but we do think that we can deal with the problem of partisan sources of information if people just know each other better, even without changing the media. You guys have all had, you know, articles forwarded to you by your friends, whether or not your friends agree with you. That's a source of information. And so if people on Capitol Hill in particular, and I have to admit, you know, when it comes to foreign policy, there are about 300 people who matter in Washington. You know, foreign policy is kind of an insider's game. And to some extent, that's got to be the way that it is. So we're trying to get to those people so that instead of it being 150 on one side and 150 on the other side who don't know each other at all, those people know each other well and they function as sort of a traditional establishment that can work together. So if those people are at least communicating, then, you know, we don't have to worry that Bill O'Reilly has no interest in converting the content of his broadcast.
More questions?
So, Matt, as I listened to you, I had two thoughts. Yes. So you went one at a time?
Go ahead.
Let's do that. So the first one is, during my lifetime, which basically is as a baby boomer, was the Cold War and then the post-Cold War. It seems obvious as I looked at your charts that one of the factors you didn't mention was an external existential threat. And obviously the high point of bipartisanship is, I wasn't alive, but it seemed like during World War II. And then in the post-World War II era, during the Cold War, when there were perceived threats, and if you look at your charts, Korean War, boom. Vietnam War, boom, Gulf of Tonkin. It keeps shooting back up right after that. So it seems like in the future, things like climate change and or nuclear proliferation and those types of threats, which obviously with technology will become more and more important, could foster bipartisanship.
Yeah, I think we would agree with that 100%. That's the purpose of putting together these statements and getting Democrats and Republicans to try and build some momentum on particularly the two issues you mentioned. I think the problem is it's putting the cart before the horse because we don't have structurally, in terms of process, we don't have the ability to communicate with one another and be taken seriously by the other side, on both sides right now, where an issue like that can actually be discussed to the point that there is a national consensus that there's some external threat. We need to unite. We need to deal with that threat. During the Cold War, we didn't have a choice. The Soviets were imposing it on us. Same could be said in World War II. You know, there may come a time where we don't have a choice on those issues, on nuclear. If there's a nuclear terror attack in the United States, it's going to be a game changer. But the probability of that happening is not negligible at the moment, and that was the point of the statement that we released on that issue. Mm-hmm. So we're trying to get the conversation going now, but, you know, it's people don't tend to act until the last possible second when they don't see a choice.
Right. All too often. So my second thought was, and I've been kicking this around for a while, but all the talk about cable news and radicalization on the on TV channels and everything and how there's no conversation anymore reminds me about the early years of the Republic and Jefferson and Hamilton and Adams and Hamilton and Jefferson and the way they attacked each other very, very personally and with salaciously and with the use of anonymous newspapers and pamphleteers. And it was at a level and a pitch that I think probably exceeds anything we've seen so far. But somehow, we seemed at some point to have gotten past that. And are there any lessons for us to learn from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's true. We've looked a lot at the history, at PSA, we've looked at the history of partisanship and bipartisanship, and there have been cycles. But I think the thing that's fundamentally changed is you've got to combine the soundbite format, the limited attention span that we have today, with the highly partisan, the highly spun content. So it's one thing if you have a very charged political pamphlet that has 30 pages of well-reasoned argument strongly in favor of one position or the other. Fine, read that one. Read the one that comes out in opposition to it. Those have become part of our political canon today because they were so good and so well-reasoned. I don't think that the 30-second clip of the Democratic Party hack or the Republican Party hack yelling at the other guy on Bill O'Reilly's show or on Keith Olbermann's show is going to become a part of our cultural political canon in the same way because it's content free. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the problem.
Content free, very good. Someone's getting up. I just want to ask a question that will make one thing clear. So in the Partnership for Secure America, you're trying to have the process in place so that when the crisis comes to unite it, that it will be ready. You're not going to use a try to create a crisis in order to create the. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that was true. All
right. Hi. I haven't had a chance to read these statements yet, but I presume these are supposed to be bipartisan statements. Tell me the process. How do I know they're bipartisan?
Well, don't take my word for it. So what we do is we'll as a staff, as an organization, we'll do some research on an issue, conversations like this going around the country, and we'll develop a draft statement. Now, we have the advantage that that we have this very distinguished senior board. And so we'll go to our two co-chairs, former Representative Hamilton, former Senator Rudman, and if we can get those two guys to agree on the content of a statement on whatever topic that we've picked. And oftentimes they say, this is not an important topic, here's what you should be writing about, and we go back to the drawing board. If we can get those bellwether Democrats and Republicans to agree, then we know we've got something. And the way I describe this, you know, from there it just sort of spins outward. We get 10 people on and then 20 people on, and then we end up with, you know, 36 of all the right voices, because quite frankly, by the end of it, it is politics. We're going to someone and we're saying, do you want to be the last Democratic holdout who's not signing on to this? Sam Nunn's on it. Warren Christopher's on it. Madeleine Albright's on it. So, and it is politics, and I freely admit that. But why are we doing it? We're doing it this way because it's not happening on Capitol Hill. That's where it should be happening. That's where the staffer who works for the Democratic member should be sitting down with the Republican staffer and saying, we've got this problem with nuclear proliferation. You know, there's still loose uranium and plutonium out there that could be, you know, bought or stolen by the wrong folks and made into a bomb. What are we going to do about it? You know, the Nunn-Lugar program is a good start. We've got to do more. What are we going to do about it? They're not doing that. They're playing politics. They're stonewalling. You look at the healthcare debate. How long has it taken us? We have nothing. And that's pushing back all the foreign policy issues that we should be dealing with.
So does it take a vote amongst this list of people to come up with the statement? And if so, what's the majority? How does it happen?
None of these people are going to put their names on anything that they have even the slightest reservation or disagreement about. So everyone whose name is on there agrees to 100% of what's in the statement. And that's the tough, the heavy lift of what we do. And to get there, it's very much like what ought to be happening on the Hill and what traditionally happened on the Hill, which is you have committee conferences, you have senators and representatives sitting down to work out a conference version of a bill, or you have debates within committee and so on. So it's a sort of sensitive, delicate, diplomatic kind of political process. But at the end of the day, it's not if the majority votes yes, the minority has to come along. This is an actual representative unanimous document.
But it's the same names on each of these statements.
No, it's a different. That's right. That's right. And so if people disagree, it's a similar set of names. But if people disagree, okay, then they won't sign on. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks.
More questions? While someone's thinking about getting up to get one, you want to tell us one of your favorite stories about someone, you know, famous that you've met when working through this process, and what they were like in reality, like how tall Henry Kissinger is?
Yeah, right. What color were Abe Lincoln's eyes? I'm not. So, actually, I saw Senator Slade Gorton, Republican from Washington, member of the 9/11 Commission. I saw his picture out in the lobby. I guess he's spoken here. Yeah. And he's a member of our board and a fantastic guy and an active member. And on our last statement, which was about climate change, I remember going back and forth with him. And, you know, he often says, and I think this is being typically humble, you know, I'm not really a foreign policy guy. Well, you know, he was a member of the 9/11 Commission, the United States Senator. He knows something about foreign policy. So we had, you know, we had one of those kind of conversations. Well, I just don't know, Matt. I don't know about the evidence. You know, I'm not skeptical about the science, but I just don't know. And we went back and forth probably a dozen times, during the course of which, obviously, I was going out to other members of the board, and the content was changing all along. So every time I went back to Senator Gorton, I would have to say, by the way, if you look at line 7, we've changed the and to an or. And so, you know, that made my job that much harder. And by the end of it, I was pretty much ready to give up on him. And he sent me this one email that said, Matt, congratulations, you're very persistent, I agree. So that was about 12 rounds into this negotiation. And so the long and short of it is, I'm doing and we're doing at PSA what congressional staff ought to be doing on behalf of their members. But the unfortunate reality is, with many exceptions, and I count among those certainly our congressional fellows that we have who are phenomenal young leaders, but it's just not happening, because it's hard work. Yes?
Yes, can you tell us a little bit about your professional background and international experience, if any?
Other than being a defunct lawyer, I did Soviet history as an undergrad at Harvard. From that, I spent some time in Russia and Ukraine. I still am very involved in that. I'm part of something called the Dartmouth Dialogues, which was started by Norman Cousins, a journalist in the 1950s. He was a personal friend of Dwight Eisenhower, and the two of them hatched this idea of sort of a back channel to the Soviets, and that is still going on. Now it's the Russians, and I think we need it more than ever now. So I do that, and I worked briefly in the Department of Defense doing military justice, essentially prosecuting American servicemen and women for violations of the UCMJ, which is the law of war, and then I came to Partnership for Secure America. So that's my background. Thanks a lot for listening, folks.
We have time for one more question, if anybody would like to ask one more question. Well, I'd like to ask a question about the last thing that you said. You were prosecuting people. What year was that? Was that after the Iraq War? I mean, that was just a couple years ago, right?
Yeah, actually, so I was at, it's called the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces. I was clerking for a judge there, so I actually wasn't prosecuting, but was advising a neutral arbiter. It was in 2005, and I guess what was sad about it is, even though we had had all of these issues with American service members, you know, Abu Ghraib and Gitmo and all this stuff where, you know, again, this is only crimes being committed by Americans. The military tribunals look at foreigners.
Right.
Those were not yet before us because we have this problem in the American justice system broadly, but in particular in the military justice system called appellate delay, which means we were actually, in 2005, we were looking at cases from 1996. So guys have been sitting in jail in military brig for 9 years, and finally their appeal was getting to us. Now, in most cases, the appeal was rejected anyway. But, you know, for someone who has a claim, that's kind of a rough deal to have to sit around in prison for 9 years before it gets heard. But, so the short answer is no, even though it was 3 years after everything had happened, we didn't get to any of that stuff.
Well, that sounds like another process that needs to be fixed. Okay, Matt, thank you very, very much, and thank the audience. And we thank all those of you who listened on the radio to this program, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California commemorating its 105th year of enlightened discussion is adjourned. Thanks a lot, Matt. That was great.